Okay.
So do we have further questions or comments?
No.
Joe?
I believe that, is it McGraw?
McGraw, he pronounces it McGraw, it looks like McGraw.
Yeah. That he began by posing the question of abstraction as a problem that it's a residue which Heidegger then picked on and focused his philosophy on that residue in a scholastic philosophy, okay? The residue that is devoid of meaning, really, and so it's left aside. And then in the discussion, so it was brought out that, well, there is meaning, but maybe when you approach the residue from another angle, you hit on another thing, which is no longer residue, okay? I was just thinking of Lonergan's rather big scheme of direct insight, let's say, in physical laws, and then the residue and the inverse insight right into what was meaningless, really, as far as the laws were concerned, and generated another type of insight.
Possibility, so, statistical.
Yeah, statistical analysis, probability and all of that. That's only one example, but it could be sort of a pattern that there are all kinds of inverse insights possible and approaches to get at what's left out, but has an intelligibility in relationship to the kind of question you are asking. I think you have to shift your ground every time to get at various intelligibilities.
Right. And it's not, that isn't the only one either, because what the one that Heidegger is after is more about the actual or the intelligibility of an individual thing or whatever, which a lot of Thomists are going to want to say, well, that the singular can't be understood. It's only the universal that they have in common, that sort of thing. But the example that I give in the paper at the seminar, Joe is remembering better than I did the seminar last year. You were at the seminar.
Yeah, I was at the seminar. Yeah.
Okay. Danny Mansour raised the objection to McGraw's paper the chemical expression, it's in my paper here, the chemical expression of the intelligibility of one hydrogen atom is exactly the same as the chemical expression of the intelligibility of another hydrogen atom. And so the this and that is the residue, and that has no intelligibility at all. Well, only from one standpoint. And it, as you said, it also is the ground of statistical, Lonergan's statistical intelligibility. But the thing that Heidegger would be getting at here would be more the thing that I gave. That may be the case, but it does make a big difference if the hydrogen atom is part of a bomb or if it's in a lake. And that depends on the history of the hydrogen atom. And that there's an intelligibility to the history that puts one of them at one place and one at the other. It's the same intelligibility, and they play the same role. And because it does this in the lake and it does that in the bomb, it's because of the same formula. But there is a real difference, and that difference is history. And that's what Heidegger's getting at, is the difference that history makes and the intelligibility in the historical unfolding of reality. And I think he's bang on. You know, and if it's something that we've got to take seriously. Michael?
An observation and I guess a question for clarification. The infant and the child thing that Bernard brought up, the relationship, I thought of it as perhaps a possible counterexample. At least in the sense of reception, like it strikes me that a child is programmed to receive the energy of the smile quite apart from whether the mother smiles or not. So, and this seems to me this isn't something that's, it's not a pattern of experience that is culturally given or is historically determined. Mm-hmm. And it's, and also that it's one that wouldn't go away necessarily despite whatever culture or history tried to do in that context. And so I guess the observation, well, and it turns to a question, I guess, too, to what are there categories of experience that are permanent or that aren't affected by...
Absolutely. Can I respond to that right now?
Well, then the other question, too, it's yeah, I'm wondering about Heidegger's truth as unconcealment. It's a long time since I read Heidegger, and you mentioned that seems to be crucial. And in your paper, you don't go into detail in terms of what he means by that,
mm-hmm.
truth as unconcealment. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just speak to that too.
Well, I mean, I don't go into detail because the paper was already very long, and I didn't want to, that's the main reason that I don't. And I would have to do some work on it. But let me come to your first question first. Absolutely, the child is patterned to receive that. There's no question about that. But it still makes a big difference whether the child does receive it or not, you know, whether it happens or not. That's the point that both Lonergan and Bob Altizer are making, is that it's that sense of welcome into the universe, you belong here, or you never get it, you know, that sort of thing. What's Erikson says, we develop a basic trust in reality by the age of four. And if we haven't, then our life is going to be much more difficult unless some miracle of grace happens along the way to give us that. I think that there's something to that, you know. There are permanent structures. I mean, anyone who's coming out of Lonergan, no one who's coming out of Lonergan would deny the permanent structures, but they're heuristic structures for meaning, for truth, for value, that they're all programmed for. And we get there by raising and answering questions. And we have to take the responsibility for those. It's not. So yes, I mean, there's a whole permanent structure that we're programmed to be loved and to love. We're programmed to find meaning, and we are not satisfied with just any meaning. We want meanings that are true, and we want to respond to what's really worthwhile. That's universal. And ultimately, if you put it into a theological context, we're all restless until we find God. That's all. That's permanent structure. The other question about the unconcealment. Aletheia. He takes apart the Greek verb, aletheia, and finds that primal truth is in the... It's a phenomenological notion of truth. The primal truth is in the unfolding of what is given. And the full, it's only found by full attentiveness to what is given. And so on. And within the framework of Lonergan's thought, that's what Lonergan means by experiential objectivity. Okay, and with that we must allow it all to unfold. Let it be, and don't abstract, and don't go off into abstraction before you've got the materials that you need. It's only that for Lonergan, the truth in its formal sense emerges only in judgment, and that's that follows upon this unconcealment, upon this experiential objectivity, following through, being faithful to the questioning process and not allowing desires and fears to interfere with the unfolding of the process until you know that you have reached sufficient evidence. And once you've got that, you must assent, or otherwise you're being fearful or whatever, that sort of thing. But it's only in judgment that it emerges. And judgment is not made at that first level, except maybe if I'm right in a very devalued sense. So I could do more with that aletheia, but I would need to do a little work on it to find the text.
Bob has a question.
Just in the outline of Hosea, just a few words on the very last two items there, organic changes and organic as related to...
Yeah.
You know, the name.
Well, if you look at the... where's my page? If you look at the statement down below from Natural Light and Historical Mindedness, there's a tidal movement that begins before consciousness. All right, so that's the organic thing. That's the before consciousness, what I'm getting at here. And that unfolds then through sensitivity, up through the dream into sensitivity and peripheral consciousness, intelligence, rational reflection, responsible deliberation, only to find rest beyond all of those and being alone. So I'm trying to, and the organic there, and the reason, one of the reasons I put it in is that there's another dimension that where psychic, the notion of psychic conversion needs to be developed, and that is in terms of the organic. And I had that quotation from Shaler in the paper about organic mendacity, which I think is one of the most brilliant things I've ever read, that the person who is organically mendacious doesn't even have to lie. They just have to be themselves, you know. And there's a whole organic way that you can carry yourself that is a lie, you know. And I put it in there too, because there's the psychic conversion. When I'm talking about psychic conversion, it reaches down to that, gets a hold of that. If you can change that, there's really a change that's taking place.
This question's for either Bob or for Meg, and perhaps you've already answered it, but in asking it this way, it might help me understand. I agree with the idea that certainly we are given meanings and values through language and through culture that we will one day have to critique ourselves. What I'm curious about is to what degree the tools that we're going to use to critique the culture we live in are already determined or are shaped by the culture and the language itself. One answer that we certainly have available to us is the theological one, the intervention of grace, but even then, even if I'm going to try and explain my experience of grace through original meaningfulness, I'm going to have to use ordinary meaningfulness to make it communicable. And therefore, doesn't the culture in some way only have a sort of, it confines the questions that are going to be asked to it to be limited in a certain way, and it's only going to allow certain questions to be asked?
Huge problem. That's the question that Lonergan asked that I quoted just a few minutes ago. When the whole texture of a civilization is heading towards disaster, how do you turn it around? But when you think I was also thinking as you were talking there, though, of what people say about Jesus and the parables, for instance, and how the extreme original meaningfulness of the parables, that he just effects this total transformation in the perception of reality through some of the stories he tells. Obviously you have to use ordinary meaningfulness, but I mean he's speaking the language of the people, but still the twist that he's putting on it is giving it a new meaning, you know. And a good preacher does that. Theologian does that.
And good art does that.
And good art does that, that's right. And good literature does that.
Following along appropriately, art. I'm always involved with art and with artists often and people who talk about art. And I want to preface my question with a memory I have way back years ago in the Thomas More Institute when Lonergan gave a talk. And there were some people there questioning him, what's the matter with the word intuition? And I understand as I understood it then, and it was years ago, that his way of understanding the process toward truth doesn't include intuition. But intuition, it seems to be such a very useful word, and it seems to be what you're talking about when you talk about the perception of data plus. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I asked another Lonerganian, what was the thing that Lonergan had against the notion of intuition? I've never understood it, really. Okay. And he thought it was because people think the notion intuition includes judgment. I don't think it does.
Okay, but some people do. That is part of the reason that
okay.
the problem was. The main reason that he had a problem with it is that it has come to mean so many different things. that, and if you want it to mean what you just said that I'm talking about, fine, I have no problem with that, and I'll use it as long as people understand that that's what I mean by
yeah.
it. That's the only difficulty that he had, that some people, they mean by intuition, some people mean what he meant by insight, and some people mean it to include judgment. And in the philosophical tradition, in the scholastic philosophical tradition, it has it's very important, because Gilson's perception of being is at the first level, and for Lonergan, you only get to being in judgment, which is the third level. Prior to that, you've got data, and you're processing the data, but you don't get to them as being until you make a judgment. Maritain's intuition of being, okay, that's problematic. If it's intuition of data plus, no problem. But it's only in judgment that this is determined to be true, and it's only through the true that we reach being. So that's the issue. The issue is basically what I said in the paper is there are so many different meanings that have been given to the word that I would prefer not to use.
Yeah.
Now, if you say that, all right, what you're talking about, data plus, is intuition, fine. Then let's use it, but let's say mm-hmm. that's what the word means.
Okay.
I don't have any problem with that.
Right. There's another related question. Maybe it's the wrong place to ask it, but if it is, say so. Interpreting art. Often what happens here, I was teaching last night about some art, and what I'm presenting to the students, I mean, I present the image, they can question, et cetera, but I present an interpretation, which is a tentative judgment, really. That's how I would understand it.
Well, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and that's, but that it's on those tentative judgments that one, I structure a theory.
Oh, I think that's right.
That's okay. That fits in, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay. Yeah.
I think Meg wants to respond to Sean.
Well, it wasn't necessarily a response. It was a question I had for you, but I think it ties into a response to Sean, and it was just around the whole notion of the individual release of original meaningfulness that has to come outside of community. Now, I think the question for me is still, always has to be mediated through a community.
Or most often it is.
Yeah, so, or if a community is going to somehow change the development of its own community or culture, then there has to be a relationship with a community outside of that community or beyond that community. So I think that's the question that Sean's really getting at. So
yeah.
How can that happen? I mean, is it possible, conceivable then that, you know, an unknown community could be surviving in the world as we speak?
I basically almost start Theology in the Dialectics of History with Paulo Freire. I mean, and I have about five pages on Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is an embodiment of a lot of what I'm talking about in the book. I'm talking about a lot more than what he's doing. But what he was doing, Paulo Freire and peasants in Brazil, working, teaching, educating peasants in Brazil, their mentality was so fatalistic that the only release could come from someone outside that system who was able effectively to communicate it does not have to be this way. I'm just starting to read Brick Lane right now by a new British novelist. I can't remember her first name yet because I've just started her last night. Ali is her last name, A-L-I, and she's from Bangladesh originally. But this whole thing is a Muslim woman finally finding a release from what for her had become so oppressive because she couldn't develop anything of her individuality. That's what the whole novel is. But she had to help to get to the point. It does not have to. She thought she had to stay in the house and do nothing but cook and sew and cut her husband's toenails and all of that. And that had to be this way.
But
and finally, she realizes it doesn't.
But don't you think there are situations either for individuals or even as groups who they know intuitively, instinctively that there's something is up here, something
yes.
is wrong here.
Right.
And so it doesn't really come from outside. It comes from...
But then it comes from a creative person within the community, creative, the release of creativity. A Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or whatever, you know. The creative minority that leads the way. But and it does come from outside the patterns that people have. That it's an intervention from outside the pattern.
I was just wondering, the patterns of experience, as I understand it, sort of they inform the ordinary meaning for those, right? And so if you were to take a people and introduce them into a new land, let's say, or a new context, they would have common concerns, you know, presumably. What would that... the interplay of the relationship between those common concerns be as they inform the pattern of experience and then the ordinary meaningfulness? Or is there any? See what?
I'm not sure I get the question, but tell me if I'm getting it from my response. You're talking about, for instance, immigrants to Canada?
Or even pioneers to this country.
Right.
You know, the people that first started. That first came,
right.
They had, you know, very real concerns, and their concerns were, you know, Lonergan's, I think Lonergan's understanding, you kind of mediate through this pattern of experience.
Well, it's a cultural, it's a cultural form of the dramatic pattern of experience, of the culture.
There's no pre-existing culture there.
Well, there is in the one that they bring with them. And that's what has informed their concerns is the culture that they bring with them. When we have a real almost human laboratory for this in Canada because of the multiculturalism of the society, because you've got the amazing thing to me when I first came here is how many different cultures participate in one and the same social infrastructure. That is not the case anywhere in my experience in the United States. It just doesn't happen. But one of the difficulties of traditional cultures moving into Canada, into Toronto, for instance, people from a traditional culture, is that as the younger people come along, they've got a tension between the values of the traditional culture and the other values that they find themselves in communication with from the mainstream or from fellow students who are from a different background, and they say, that's cooler than this, you know, I want to go that way, and then they've got a problem at home. Yeah. But it's common sense, dramatic pattern. The intellectual pattern, Lonergan's intellectual pattern, is all original meaningfulness. You know, it's not the ordinary meaningfulness. It's asking questions that lead to new insights.
It's
Jill.
No, it's okay.
Yes. Meg or Vernon, would you like to make any closing comments?
I think I might.
I just want to thank everybody.
Thank you. So thank you to all three presenters. And next door in the faculty lounge, there are refreshments for those of you who would like to so engage.
I told you I would get it.